Future holidays. I got a list of things to do from Peggy. Now, in all fairness, it was a verbal list. It wasn't actually typed up or anything like that. But and I found out over the years that actually it's a good thing to get started on it, not to wait to the last minute. It doesn't go well if I'm doing some of those particular things and company is getting there and I've still got the vacuum cleaner out or whatever it may be. So I got started on some of those things the evening before, and then even early morning before we left for church, I took in, got some of the additional things going. And we made our way to church, and I'm not sure, I think most of us feel this way, that Easter is one of the highlights for worship throughout the whole year. I remember that particular Sunday, the singing was especially special. And so we left, we got home about noon, which gave me a little time to get the rest of the things done on my list. And then we were eating dinner somewhere in the dining room about 2 to 2:30 when the phone rang. Peggy went to our bedroom to get it. We had a landline in the bedroom, and she came on back, and she kind of waved me on into the laundry room. She wanted to talk to me privately. John McAdams had called, Linda's husband, had called our house. Peggy was trying to talk to me, but she was crying so hard. It was tough to understand what she was saying, but I got the gist of it. Our dear sister from Northtown, Carol Rodebeck, had just died in a car accident on the way home. And I'm thinking to myself, this has got to be a dream. You know, do you ever have one of those dreams that are so real you can't differentiate between real and being in that dreamlike state? And it wasn't, though. And I was just absolutely numb. Carol was just with us. I saw her singing up front in the praise team that morning. In fact, one particular song, I can picture right now, she had her eyes closed, and she was looking up towards the sky, and she had this big smile on her face. And you wondered where she had drifted on off to. But wherever it was, you almost wish you could have joined her at that point. Then after service, I saw her and her family get into the car and drive on off. I repeatedly found myself that afternoon asking myself, why? Why would this happen? She had a young family and a husband still to take care of. Why? You know, 21 years later, I still don't know the answer to that question. And unfortunately, that wasn't an isolated incident for this church family. Dolores Smith, taken so young with cancer. Greg Davis. That's a tough one. Jermaine Bryant. Michael Fox, killed in a car accident. He wasn't even 21 years old. And his brother died from an overdose. At Southside, we've mourned our losses. We've had Michael Heff killed on a bike while he was riding. Rick Boss and Juan from COVID. You know, James is right. Life is like a vapor. It's like a mist that comes on up in the morning and it's gone when the sun comes on out. And I do apologize if it seems like we're starting on off kind of on a depressing note with this sermon. But the fact is, most people, even Christians, don't like to spend much time talking about their mortality. We just don't. But you can't deny the numbers. George Bernard Shaw has this saying. He said, the statistics on death are quite impressive. One out of one people die. So let me show you, if I can, how most people deal with this subject. It's a little snippet from a show called The Middle. Ben, could you hit that for us?
Hey, Brick. You ready for Santa? Brick, what's the matter? Mike? Why isn't Brick talking?
Yeah, I thought you might ask about that. I had that little chat with him, trying to get him out of his funk. Hey, buddy, we need to talk. What's going on? Your mom and I are worried about you.
I'm just a little melancholy.
When did all this start?
You know that Santa Pest dispenser I got 2 years ago where the candy comes out of his beard? I just started thinking about how I had it, and then one day it was just gone. And then I started thinking that someday you'll be gone, and I'll be gone, and we'll all be gone.
Well, sure. Everybody worries about death. It's terrifying. But you know what we do? We shove it out of our minds. That's why we have books and candy and water parks and TV. It's all just a big old distraction from death. So, all better?
Okay.
Okay.
I wouldn't necessarily pick water parks and candy as my main distraction, but you get the point. You would think because death is not only just probable, it's absolutely certain. And since there's no guarantee if we're going to live years or hours, and at the end of that time, every single person stands accountable before God. You would think because of all that, every single one of us, non-believers and believers, would be trying to figure out how to get right with God. But oddly enough, most people put death out of their mind and act as if it's just never going to happen. In Psalm 90, Moses laments about this brevity of life himself. He kind of compares it to the grass sprouting in the morning, and by the evening it's withered and gone. And then in verse 12 of the same chapter, Moses calls out to God and says, "Teach us, God, to number our days so that we may present to you with a heart of wisdom." Why would Moses ask God to teach us to number our days? You know, I did the math myself using the average expectancy of a man in the United States living to 76.1 years old. I'm just about 64, so if you do the math, 64 over 71, 76.1, and times 100, it gives you 84%. 84% is behind me. 16% is left. I've heard it said that life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes. But seriously, the reason, though, God wants us to number our days is because if we ignore our mortality, we will not live life properly in the light of eternity. We will not desire a heart of wisdom that Moses prayed for. Let me give you an example, I think, that helped make sense of living our life properly in the light of eternity. You've heard it said that youth is often wasted on the young. There's a lot of different directions you can go with that statement. But one way is to see how youth can be wasted is for them not to fully understand that what they do with their life during those early years, those years they're in school, typically from about 5 years old to about 21, 22, that window about 17 years often sets the course for the rest of their life. I.e., am I going to be in a job that I like and makes use of my talents, or because of my lack of preparation and training, I'm finding that I don't have many choices or options that are favorable. This concept that this small time frame should have such a large impact on the remainder of one's life is unfortunately more than some can comprehend at such a young age. And hopefully that's where the guidance of parents and teachers come along to help give wisdom in those situations. But it's tough for some young people because they can't see beyond the here and the now. For some, the mindset is there'll be time to deal with that later, which often never happens. I'm going to do a visual here if I can. I'm sure some of you have seen this before, but it really plays on out well. Evan, would you walk that maybe back even a little bit further for me? You know, this is a long rope. Unfortunately, to make the point, I was looking for a rope that goes on forever, but you can't find them anymore. They're really tough. So, but you get the point if you look. And Evan, you don't have to go through the door down to the street. That I think it'll go there, but that's fine. You look at this small section right here. Can you see the black? That's our physical existence. Everything we do in this little snippet affects everything from that point on forever. And when I look to Scripture, as far as I know, there's only two options that come after that, heaven or hell. And just like the child regarding those early years, unless we number our days and take them seriously, living them with wisdom and purpose, we will not live them properly in the light of eternity. You know, Mickey Mantle used to have a saying. He said, he's a famous New York baseball player. He said in his later years, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. You know, of course he was talking about his mortality, his physical life, but it works good from a spiritual standpoint too. Satan, on the other hand, I think is just satisfied if he can keep us busy in the hecticness of life. And living with wisdom in the light of eternity can help us in a number of different other ways. First of all, don't assume that there's plenty of time left. I think this is one of Satan's biggest lies. I've given you plenty of examples. It's between Northtown and Southside again, that's not really the case. And I think every single one here has examples of their own, of situations that support that. It's been said that those who wait for the 11th hour to get right with God often die at 10:30. Numbering our days and living with a heart of wisdom should also affect aspects of our Christian walk. I remember Damian Reed, he was a brother from Northtown who had terminal cancer. He was so on fire for Christ. I remember he told me one time that diagnosis of cancer took away any inhibitions he had for giving himself totally to Christ. And he let anybody and everybody that would listen know it. And for that matter, I've got to believe that Christians dealing with similar situations gravitate more to the hope of God that he holds out to us just out of necessity than the average believer. To those dealing with such issues, the words of James in chapter 1, verse 12 have to really have just a special meaning. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. So what does James want us to take out of these five verses? I think there's several things buried within them. First and foremost, get right with God. Come to grips with the idea that we're not guaranteed anything beyond this moment, and let that change the way we think and act. Satan will try to convince you otherwise. I remember Kevin telling me about Allison after she had heard the gospel. I guess she had a plane to catch, and she insisted that she wasn't going to get on that plane until she was baptized. I think these verses call us to live with a sense of urgency, and as such, to prioritize activities in our life. They call us to glorify God with the gift of time that he has given us, to work on our relationships, to use the talents he's given us for the advancement of his kingdom. It calls us to be more prayerful. It calls us to have a desire to let God change us. Clarence Darrow, the attorney, once said, "When we fully understand the brevity of life, its fleeting joys and inevitable pains and suffering, when we accept the fact that all men and women are approaching this inevitable end, it should make us more kind and considerate of others. It should make us use our best efforts to help our fellow travelers on this road, to make the path brighter and easier for those in our lives. It should bring a closer kinship and a deeper sympathy for the wayfarers with whom we share a common life and a common death." What else is James trying to tell us in these five verses? Verse 13 tells us, "Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money." So in these verses, is James trying to tell us not to make plans for the future because life is so fleeting? Or is he against engaging in business for profit. There may be some that believe that we should simply live by faith, trusting God without giving much thought at all to planning or preparation, that planning and faith are opposed to each other. If that's true practically, you should use that understanding for anything, for your finances, for your health care, for your retirement, for church outreach, and I guess even for sermons. But Proverbs 21:5 tells us the plans of the diligent lead to profit, but everyone who is hasty comes to poverty. So what do you do with these potentially conflicting thoughts, planning versus no planning? James was certainly challenging these Christian businessmen, not necessarily about their planning, but how they were planning for the future. These businessmen were probably Jewish Christians who had been scattered throughout the ancient world because of persecution. In their planning, they seem to have covered the who, we, the when, today or tomorrow, the why, for profit, the where, this or that city, and for how long, a year. They had all the bases covered except for one thing. What did they leave out, or probably better yet, who did they leave on out? God. We have to understand that for James, there's no separation between secular and spiritual. The definition of atheism means that you don't believe in God or a divine being, that everything around us is due to chance. We're not only made by chance, with evolution being this big game of randomness. Supposedly, we even find ourselves sitting here in these pews by chance. There's no divine being that led us to this point. But sometimes when you talk to such a person, you'll hear one say, you know, I think everything happens for a purpose. You think to yourself, when you hear something like that from a non-professing person, you'd ask why? Why do you think everything happens for a purpose if you don't believe in God? The point is, even though some profess atheism, they live really as practical theists, living and believing that some higher power does exist and ultimately works for their own good. Kind of sounds really like what Paul talked about in Romans 8:28. It's called practical theists. Similarly, it's not unusual to have Christians who profess their faith in God, profess their faith in Jesus, go to church, read their Bibles, but when it comes to their secular life, their work, their family, their home life, their friends, their planning for the future, God and his kingdom are not intertwined into those things in their life. Just like the businessman that James is talking about, it's called practical atheism. And I think at times we're all guilty of it. I'm inching towards retirement, I'm inching towards it. In my planning, how is God going to be a part of that to advance his kingdom? For those in college, how's your decision on your vocation intertwined with God's plan? For those that are dating, have you considered God when choosing who to go out with? And for all of us, how's God tied in to our financial planning? Let's not be practical atheists. Not only don't we see God in these businessmen's plans, we also see God being challenged by these men regarding his sovereignty. They were assuming who was in control of their future. They were. I think many of us, like these businessmen that James is referring to, we'd like to script our own future if we could. And actually, I think we would do it very, very similar like they did. We're going to go here or there. We're going to do this or that, and things are going to go rather well. We'll make a profit. We'll travel. We'll climb up the ladder. We'll have fun along the way, and we'll retire well. And we're not going to script in any glitches either. Most of us would prefer Jimmy Stewart's take on life from The Wonderful Life. He said, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day. I know what I'm going to do next year and the year after that. The problem is, we know life seldom goes like that as we would like to draw it on up. You know, this whole section of James in chapter 4 and 5, it does have a connecting theme of humility, humbling ourselves before others, and ultimately humbling ourselves before God. James talks about things like avoiding favoritism, taming our tongue, not quarreling, and having to have things our way. And Kevin last week talked about not slandering others. Now, James turns to the subject of humility in regards to the future and ultimately our desire to be in control of it. It's tough enough to humble ourselves to others, But man, it's really tough to humble ourselves to God regarding the future. Submitting to what it has in store for us. Even with our prayer life, we ask for guidance. We ask for clarity. What that often means is that we want a glimpse into the future so that we know the best course to take on things. We don't want to get hurt. We don't want to make a mistake. We want things to go well for us. Sometimes we pray simply because we want God's blessings on our plans. James in chapter 4, verse 3 tells us, "You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly, so you can spend it on your own passions." Brennan Manning tells the story of a man by the name of John Cavanaugh who went to work for 3 months at the House of the Dying in Calcutta. He was trying to figure out best how to spend the rest of his life. On his first morning, he met Mother Teresa, and she asked him, "What can I do for you?" Cavanaugh asked, "Could you pray for me?" She responded, "What can I pray for?" So he expressed the deepest desires of his heart. "Pray that I may have clarity in my life." She responded, "No, I'm not going to do that." Cavanaugh was taken back by her response. She continued, "Clarity is the last thing you are clinging to, and you need to let go of it." Cavanaugh commented that she always seemed to have clarity, which he longed so much for. When she heard this, she laughed. She said, "I've never had clarity. What I have had is trust. So I will pray for you to learn to trust God in any situation that he puts you in." We think with clarity we'll find happiness. If I move here, will it work on out? If I marry this person, will I be happy? If I take this job, will it be profitable? You know, it's probably no coincidence that Job is the oldest book in the Bible. In a sense, it sets the tone for the core of the Bible. At its core, it's a story about trust in the midst of chaos. Really no answers, no explanation, no clarity, a call to trust God. Paul reminds us of that same call to trust in Romans 8:28 when he says, "We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him." Jesus did tell us in this life that we're going to have problems. We're going to have trouble. I think it's important to embrace what C.S. Lewis says about in regards to this. He said, "The great thing is, if one can, is to stop regarding all the unpleasant things as interruptions of one's own real life. The truth is, of course, that what one calls the interruptions are precisely one's real life, the life God is sending one day at a time." We've been talking about the gift of time that God has given us. I found myself guilty at times because of challenging circumstances of just wishing away segments of my life. I just wish this week or this month was over with because it's been really a difficult time for me. To do this, though, even though it's human, is wrong on at least 2 different levels. First, there's usually more trouble and challenges to come, and if I keep on doing this, I'm just going to simply wish most of my life away. Second, I miss the beauty of becoming utterly dependent upon God during those times. All right, so let's finish by looking at the last verse if we can, verse 17. "If any then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, to him it is sin." At first glance, this verse seems somewhat disjointed from the other verses preceding it. Like it was almost slapped on as an afterthought. But it begins with a then, or if many translations, with a therefore. So we're really not given that liberty to separate it from these preceding verses. And James is really following in the footsteps of Jesus in the way he phrases this verse. Jesus gave us the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, the saying really wasn't all that new in the ancient world, but it had been taught in a different way than Jesus presented it. It was more along the lines of, don't do to others what you don't want done to you. For example, I wouldn't want somebody to steal from me, so I shouldn't steal from them. We would call these sins of commission, sins that I commit because of an action that I took. Jesus turned that upside down, basically saying that's not good enough. You treat someone like how you desire to be treated yourself. So now it's not good enough to avoid engaging in destructive behavior with another. Jesus calls us to a standard of being treated like we want to be treated. And so James runs with this and says, if you know there's good to be done around you and you don't do it, you sin. We would call this the sins of omission. You didn't go out of your way to hurt somebody, but similarly, you didn't go out of your way to help somebody who needed it. Obviously, we can't meet every single need we see around us. There just wouldn't be enough time or money to do that. But everyone here has been given spiritual gifts to serve in God's kingdom. Kevin's talked the last couple of weeks about our mission statement. Everyone here being a part of either reaching on up, reaching in to serve the family, or reaching on out to serve the community. James is calling us out on this. If you see a need and you ignore it, and that goes for the needs of Southside, you're sinning. James doesn't mince any words here. If you're not serving in some capacity, it's a big deal. As we close, let's remember, since life is short, it's so important to involve God in our plans. In life, some won't make it past high school. Some will only make it to the 30s or 40s. Whatever time frame God has given you, you need to use it wisely. Christ only lived to his 30s, but in that time, he forever turned the world upside down. Moses really, in a sense, didn't get on fire for God until his 80s, but he sure made use of that time. To not have God in our plans is to waste our time. Pray that God teaches us to number our days so we understand the brevity of life and we can live it in light of eternity. Solomon in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 verse 1 says, remember your creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. He's telling the youth, don't waste your younger years. Dedicate them to the Lord and use them for God's kingdom. Let's all of us be wise with our time. You know, rocks really aren't that valuable, basically because there's lots of them. But gold and diamonds are valuable because there's just not much of them. How much more precious is our time more than gold and silver? Dedicate it to the Lord and use it to the best of your ability. If there's anybody here who needs the prayers of the congregation, you can do that now while we stand and we sing.